Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A few years ago, Bradford Pearson sat down to compose a letter unlike anything he had ever written.
Hello, my name is Brad Pearson. In March 2006, you were one of three people who kidnapped me in West Philadelphia. I'm writing this letter not because I'm angry at you or upset or hurt. The opposite, actually. While the kidnapping investigations were difficult for me, in the end they made me a stronger man. I'm a magazine writer now, and I've always hoped to talk to you and Jerry and Morty about that night and what your lives have been like since. I'd either like to do that by letter or in person. I can travel to Pennsylvania to speak with you if you'd allow me to. I also included my email address if that's easier for you. Again, I'm not angry. I'd really just like to talk. Sincerely, Brad Pearson.
Today, Brad Pearson is managing editor at Southwest, the magazine. His article, My Kidnappers, appears in the September edition of Philadelphia Magazine and is online at phillymag.com. He joins us now to talk about the experience that motivated it. Brad, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You're not angry. How is this possible?
Well, it's been 9 years, and that helps a lot. I was angry for a long time. I was angry. I was confused. I was sad, depressed, all the things that happen when something this rough happens to someone. But over the course of time, and I state this in the story, I really have no idea how I got over it, how I went from having those terrible emotions, and terrible for me and terrible towards someone else, to the point where I am now, which is, I don't know. I feel like I am in a much, much better place than I was before, and a place of forgiveness that I've reached. I can't point to one specific event that led me to get there.
Tell us what happened in 2006.
In 2006, I was walking off college campus one night in late March. Two men approached me, walked past me initially, and then came back, held a gun to my head, threw me in the back of a waiting car where a third person was, drove me around for a few hours and threatened repeatedly to kill me over and over again, cleaned out my bank account, and then mock executed me in an abandoned lot in West Philadelphia and left me and told me I'd never say anything about it. That obviously did not happen.
Yeah. I mean, this was so far beyond like being mugged, you know, momentarily. It was really sadistic the way they treated you.
It was. There was also a lightness to it that at the time I think was a coping mechanism that I recognized while I was in the backseat of the car, where I recognized that they were young. I'd never really saw their faces when it was happening. I couldn't identify them in police lineups in the future, but I could hear in their voice that they were either my age or younger than me. So that gave me a small sense of comfort into thinking that maybe they didn't really know what they were doing. And then that would be broken by the idea of them saying that they were going to slit my throat.
These guys, they were teenagers. They were on a crime spree. There were a dozen other victims beside you who had experienced similar assaults.
That's true. Yeah. I was just one of, again, a dozen victims. I was one of the victims at the beginning of the spree. I was the first victim where they had a real gun, which sort of change things. And again, I didn't know that this was happening across the city. It wasn't reported, or police either didn't know that they were connected at the time, or it hadn't been made public that this was happening. After my incident and then future incidents, the police started tying them all together because of just the oddness of all of them. They were obviously by three young men every time, but it was college students, pizza delivery men, and it was all men. Every single one was a man, which I still don't completely understand the psychology behind only robbing and kidnapping men. Even though they easily kidnapped me, I imagine it would have been easier to kidnap many women. So there was something going on there that I never quite understood.
Did you get to make like a victim impact statement at the trial?
I did. It only went to a pretrial, so, and then they all pled out, but we all gave our statements in court, and that was difficult. It was probably the most difficult because I was sitting up and I was watching my father and girlfriend at the time and now wife in the audience and how they had to deal with it emotionally. And I believe I told them almost everything that happened even before going into court, But when you have a lawyer asking you questions, it provokes different emotions. And watching the emotions of them in the court made it more difficult for me, not to testify, but emotionally myself.
So there's the story that you tell the people you are really closest to and feel safe being vulnerable with, your girlfriend, your father. Then there's the sort of cocktail party version of the story that you tell to people. And there was a point at which you realized those were two different stories.
Yeah, I think that when I first realized that I was alive and that I was free to go on with my life, you know, the next day, next week, it became, I mean, I was 21 years old. I was on a college campus and I had survived. So there was this idea of minor celebrity that sort of washed over me. And I used that and abused it. I would leave class and say that I was going to go talk to a detective. I would go to a bar, and I don't think I paid for a drink this whole second semester of my college, senior year, excuse me. And eventually I realized that that was just worthless. There was no reason for me to be doing it. It was a way to sort of mask my emotions. And
because meanwhile you were having nightmares.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Really,
I mean,
traumatized.
My public persona was the complete opposite of what I was going through internally. And at night, home alone or walking through a parking lot, those internal emotions were completely masked by me walking around, you know, pretending that everything was great and that I was somehow cooler for having gotten kidnapped. It was a machismo of a 21-year-old.
So these guys were all locked up. What made you start thinking about, and I would imagine you thought about it for a long time before you took action, what made you start thinking, I want to write to them, I want to ask them some questions?
Well, I want to say maybe within the first week of getting kidnapped, I had written a long 5,000 or 6,000 word version of just what happened that night to me. And I submitted it to a literary journalism class that I was in. So very early on, I had started writing about my emotions and trying to figure out what this all meant, if for no other reason than preservation of my thoughts for what I had hoped to be a future trial. But I think I also realized at some point that this is probably the most interesting thing that might happen in my entire life, whether good or bad.
Yeah.
And I wanted to document that. And then every couple of years, I would come back to it and edit that a little bit more and a little bit more. And then slowly I started realizing that that story wasn't interesting. It was one person's account of an awful night, and you couldn't learn anything from it. It was basically a diary in long form, essay form. And I guess it was maybe 2 years ago I started thinking and really trying to explore my own mind whether I would want to talk to them. And then last spring, I really started thinking more and more about how I can move the ball forward on this story. And that's when I started writing the letters to them.
When you got the envelope back, the first envelope, what do you remember about before you opened it? Was it like in the movies where you hand it to someone else and you say, I don't know what's in this, I can't do it? Or were you really eager to see what was inside?
I was eager, but there was also, I mean, I had the letter sent to my office and not my house. Mm-hmm. So if that's any indication of what I was actually thinking deep down, is I had no idea whether they would be okay with speaking to me. And that's an important part in all of this, is that they had to give permission for me to even come to the prison to talk to them. So this is really a two-way street in terms of all of us sharing our stories. But for the letter, I saw it. It was just in my mailbox at work. I pulled it out and opened it while I was standing there at the mailbox and started to read it, because I genuinely wanted to know. I had forgiven them, and I wanted to know where they stood emotionally, where they stood physically. For the past 9 years, we'd spent our lives completely different. I had moved all over the country, and they moved from prison to prison across Pennsylvania. So I really just wanted to know as soon as I could what the letter said.
Did you want to know if they still thought about you?
That's a good question. I don't know if I ever expressly thought that, but probably deep down I was thinking they have to think about me, because every single day they're reminded, they wake up, they look at the walls, they know that they're not going to leave those walls. So there had to be some thought on their part of, okay, maybe not thinking about me specifically, but thinking about one of the 12 of us over the course of that day, or thinking about whatever led up to that, or thinking about the trial, or thinking about something that reminded them why they were there. So I don't know if I wanted them to be thinking about me, but I expected them to be at least thinking about something tangentially related to it.
You met two out of the three.
I did.
And you found after a bit of conversation that in different circumstances, these might be guys you'd be friends with.
Yeah, it's they're both sweet people. And I know this is a really hard thing to say, and it's a really hard thing for people to believe. And if you read any of the comments on my story, you'll...
People disapprove of the fact that you've extended any forgiveness to them.
That is a very mild way of saying that. Mm-hmm. Yes. Most people think that everything they did in my presence was fake. And in the story, I expressed some doubt about that after the first day that I met with them, that I had no idea whether they were putting this on as a show, because it is self-serving. If they're nice to me, the parole board sees that and they can get out. But I felt like they couldn't keep it up for as long as they did. You know, over the hours and hours that I spent with them, there would have been some cracks that I would have been able to find if I thought that they were lying or being less than truthful about either their apologies or... It's hard to mask who you really are for a long time. And I spent 3 days in and out of the jails with them, and I think at some point I would have figured out, okay, this is all a charade.
They came from different backgrounds, and consequently, you worry a lot less about one than the other.
That's true. And I worked really hard when I was writing the story to not have that worry come off as patronizing. And some people still think it did. If you read,
it's hard to make the internet love you universally.
No, and I didn't expect anything less of the internet. I think that Jerry has a very, very good safety net at home, and it was hard for me to look at all of Jerry's past and think how he got from A to B. You know, he grew up in a working class family with a mother and father that cared very much about him and siblings. And Tyree had a much rougher childhood. And I hope that he has a system that allows him to succeed when he does get out. And because I do think that he'll get out next year. And I hope he does, because I think he can be a great member in this society. It was hard seeing two different people and knowing that they're there for the same crimes, but then also realizing that they would have very different paths when they left prison.
My guest this hour is Bradford Pearson. He's editor at Southwest the Magazine, and his article, My Kidnappers, appears in the September edition of Philadelphia Magazine. Just ahead, we'll bring John Wilson into the conversation. He's founder of an organization called Just Alternatives, which seeks to support victims and survivors of violence by promoting personal accountability by offenders, sometimes creating opportunities for victims and offenders to interact after the crime. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In the last segment, we met Bradford Pearson, managing editor of Southwest the Magazine, who was abducted and robbed at gunpoint his senior year in college, and years later felt compelled to contact the young men serving prison sentences for attacking him. He's still with us, and joining us now from a studio in Maine is John Wilson. He is director of an organization called Just Alternatives, which seeks to support victims and survivors of violence by promoting personal accountability by offenders and creating opportunities for victims and offenders to interact after the crime. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm happy and honored, really, to be here with you and with Brad.
Your organization facilitates what's called victim-centered victim-offender dialogue, which is a sort of formalized version of the experience that Brad Pearson created for himself. How did you get started on this?
Well, I guess I got started because I read about a couple who met with one of the two men who abducted, raped, and murdered their 18-year-old daughter a couple of weeks after returning from her first year away at college. And in the course of reading about this encounter between the parents and one of the offenders, I thought, how does anybody do that? Because if I were the father, I would just want to strangle these guys. Yeah. And so I talked with the father by phone. This is some years later. And he helped me understand how and why he needed to do that, to get some answers, to get some understanding of how a person could do that.
To be clear, the goal of your program is not reconciliation. It's not forgiveness for the offenders. Sometimes that happens. But many people mistakenly assume that anybody that comes to you is ready and willing to say, I forgive my offender.
Right. And thank you for seeing and making that distinction, because it's a really important one. You know, when I talk about this work with people who have not been victims of violent crime or a violation, their first thinking is, oh, that's great. The victim gets to forgive the offender, who gets to apologize. And I have to say, well, actually, there are some victim survivors who want to forgive, who actually do want to forgive the offender, want to see that the offender understands that they want to forgive. But there are many, many more victim survivors who have no interest in forgiving, who just want to say to the offender, this is what you did to me. This is what you took from me. You know, either, you know, I hope you do okay in prison, or I hope you rot in prison, whatever they may feel, any number of things. But their need is to be heard by the offender, by the person who committed the crime, who committed the harms. And that's what is most important to them.
A lot of victims or survivors of victims have questions for the offenders.
Right. And that's perhaps the most common question, is why. Why did you do this? Why did you do this to me or to my loved one? What did any of us do, if anything, to cause this? Because that's a big question for a lot of survivors. And then if you're going to get out, are we going to be safe? And is society going to be safe? How do we know you're not just going to want to do this again?
What kind of questions did you have, Brad?
My main question revolved around who they were as people. And I recognize that that's a little bit different than a lot of victims have because of my position as a journalist. And I think that I went into this process much differently than most other victims. And I imagine most other victims of the same crimes that I had committed against me would go in with. I wanted to know about their families. I wanted to know about them. I wanted to know about their day-to-day lives. And yes, that was to help color my story, but it was also to sort of see what the 16 or 17 years leading up to the night we met was like for them, and what the 9 years after that was like. And that really helped humanize them in my eyes, which is, I didn't go in, I went in having forgiven them, but I was always willing to go back on that if something happened while I was there that led me to do that. But that was what I really wanted to know mostly, was who they were. And over the course of my time talking with them, it really took me a while each time to get to the crimes in general. I think with each of them, maybe over the first day, it took more than an hour before I ever talked about any of the crimes, I think. I can go back through my notes, but I really don't remember doing it very early on in our conversations. We all knew what happened, so.
John, you, first of all, it's a very long preparation process for victims in particular before these take place. And you also require, these only happen if the offender is sort of willing to meet with the victim. Can you talk about why that's important?
Yes. First of all, in every victim-offender dialogue program in the country, and there are 31 of them active, 32 states have done them, but 31 of them, one of the states is not very active right now. It is a requirement that the victim-offender dialogue request can only be initiated by the victim survivor. You might imagine that there are offenders who would like the opportunity to apologize and to ask for forgiveness. But experience has shown that that kind of request by an offender presented to a victim survivor is usually re-victimizing. Hmm. It forces the survivor to say, well, you know, should I let this guy apologize? He doesn't even know what he's apologizing for. You know, he doesn't even know what he did. All he knows is he committed a murder. He committed a crime. He's doing time. And that's really the case. They really honestly do not understand what they have done. So it's important that the survivor get to be the one who initiates the request. But if you don't have the offender being willing to participate in the process, then you can't trust that you have a chance of reaching a kind of authentic interaction between the survivor and offender. The offender has to have that buy-in, has to believe that that something good, quote-unquote, can happen as a result of this conversation. And it might be selfish good. It might be the offender thinking, this will look good in my parole file. Or it might be, you know, I really feel terrible about what I did, and I would like to say that I feel terrible to the person I did it to. The problem is, it's hard to tell what's real, as Brad alluded to. I haven't seen the comments. I read the piece. It's a beautifully written piece, by the way, Brad.
Oh, thank you.
But I want to say that, you know, there are offenders who are extremely good at kind of manipulating the feelings of those who are basically extremely good in their hearts. It's hard for most of us to think in the same way that criminals do, because we don't have the same kinds of needs. We don't have criminogenic needs. We don't have the needs that they have. And I'm making a generalization, and I can't help it, but I've been doing this for almost 16 years now. And this is what I've seen and learned over the years. And what matters is, I mean, no facilitator and few survivors are going to transform an offender. But they are going to awaken an offender to the impacts and effects of what he or she has done. And more importantly, the survivor is going to get to say, this again, this is what you did to me. And I need to tell you, whether you hear it, whether you feel anything, I just need to tell you, because I know that I've been carrying this burden around for all these years, and you maybe haven't. And I want you to carry some of this, because it's not fair that I'm getting to carry it all. I don't know if I got off track. Did I answer your question, Chris?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
John, do you draw a distinction between being a criminal and committing a crime? Are there both kinds of people in jail today?
Yes, I would draw that distinction. I'm not a criminologist, I hasten to add. And I'm not a psychologist, I should add that quickly too. But I've encountered people who have done terrible things in impulsive moments, committed murders in impulsive moments, were not predatory, calculating, cunning people who wanted to extinguish a life. And yet something happened, some set of circumstances went down that they made the choice to commit a murder. I'm not talking about vehicular, drunken driving, vehicular homicides or anything like that. I'm just talking about intentional, for whatever length of time, intentional moments where someone decided to pull a trigger or drive a knife into the body of another. And those people, you know, they are, you can see and feel how much they would give almost anything to undo what they had done. Others, you know, they made a choice that was more calculated, that they it didn't matter to them, you know, that they had to take a life. That was, in a way, just to use a coarse term, collateral damage. There is a difference, and it can be hard for the facilitator and certainly for the survivor to kind of distinguish that. And that's one of the reasons the preparation process has to take so long. And, you know, for me, the average preparation process is probably about a year of meetings once a month or so for a few hours. It's not like we're meeting once a week for a year, but time needs to pass. And so there, I need time to get a sense of the sense that Brad was alluding to about, you know, you can get a sense of the person within a few hours. And that's true. You can. At some point, they will, as it were, give up something that makes you know, okay, they're serious or authentic or they're not. But for me, it takes more than that. It takes more than hours. It takes months. And that was the way I was trained, and that's the way I believe a facilitated dialogue should take place. And by the way, a number of survivors have managed to make these kinds of dialogues happen on their own by writing and getting on the visit list of an offender and going in and seeing the offender. But it's a different experience from the facilitated dialogue, which takes place in a very private, confidential, very safe setting at the prison.
Brad, I can imagine, like a lot of victims, that in the years that followed the attack, you would think back on it, whether you wanted to or not, it would come back into your brain. And I wonder about the extent to which the people who threatened you and kidnapped you and robbed you sort of loomed large in your mind and almost became monstrous in your imagination, and how that did it change when you sat with them in a controlled situation and talked to them? And did that help you at all?
I think, if anything, the idea of them being monsters diminished over the years, because at that point it became sort of an abstract idea of something that had happened 9 years ago to me that certainly had a profound effect at the time and really changed the course of my life in a lot of ways. When I sat down, I was lucky enough, and I didn't recognize it at the time, but I was lucky enough that the first day when I sat down with them, it was through telephonic. So I could see them through the screen. I was at the prison, but I wasn't sitting next to them. And I think that there was some value in that I could still speak with them. I could still see them. I could still read their body language and understand how the emotions hung on their face when I would ask them questions or how long it would take in pauses. But it also helped me feel a sense of security, I think, somewhere deep down, that everything's fine.
They can't touch you.
They can't touch me, yeah. And it's not something that I thought that when I was going in the first day, the prison told me that was how it was going to be, and I was disappointed, and I was a little pissed. And I said, I thought that I was coming here to speak with them. They're like, not today. You're going to be on telephonic. And in the end, I think it really did help me because as the days went on, I would meet with them individually. And then the final day, we all met together. And I think that sort of upward slope of connectivity really helped me work into our, I guess, familiar relationship by the end.
John, what kinds of responses have you observed in people?
You mean offenders being meeting with the survivors?
Did survivors meeting the offenders, did that sort of take away some of the terror that they had held if they themselves were victimized?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the difference in Brad's situation from many of the situations, although not all, that I've been involved with, is that these were teenagers and the adult offenders are a little bit different. I mean, many of us could identify and empathize with even a criminal juvenile, depending on the harm. When the offenders are adults, it's a little harder. There are obviously orders of magnitude that occur with different kinds of cases. Every case is different. Every survivor is different. Every offender is different. But the survivors, when they are allowed and enabled to give full voice to the pain that they have experienced, and this is the job of the facilitator, to help them find that voice. when they are allowed to give that voice, to direct that voice toward the offender, there is something very powerful that happens. There's an unburdening for sure. There, you know, it's not a kumbaya thing. It's not a reconciliation thing. They might not have, there's nothing, they didn't have a conciliatory relationship in the beginning. It's not nothing to reconcile. But what they want to do is be heard. And when they are allowed to do so fully, they feel so relieved, almost regardless of how the offender takes it. That is to say, if the offender is basically unmoved by something that has traumatized your life, there are offenders like that. You know, you go in there and you bare your soul, and the offender basically, not in well-facilitated or prepared cases, but in effect, shrugs his shoulders, you know, and says, I'm sorry. You know, we all got to get over our hurts.
That would be
offenders. Yeah, it would be. So what I have to do as a facilitator, there are offenders like that. I can't change them. So I have to make sure that the survivor understands full well that this is likely to happen, that when you get in there and say what you want to say, he may evidence absolutely no feeling. You may get no sense of feeling, no sympathy, no empathy, nothing. And I just need you to know that. And if you want to proceed, we'll do it. If you don't, we'll stop it. And when they know that, when they know that's possible, then they're prepared. That's our job, to prepare them for just about everything we can. But what's great about it is they can see, okay, this is how the offender is. This is how it was possible for this person to commit this kind of crime. Doesn't make it better. Certainly doesn't make it right. But, you know, you understand it in a way that you cannot unless you can, you know, encounter the offender. By the same token, the offender sees something that he has pretty much never seen. Victim impact statements are relatively new in our system, court system. And those are so important. When offenders can listen to a survivor talk or read a statement, that's a powerful thing in a courtroom at the sentencing. Hear the music. So.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break here. My guests are John Wilson, who is founder of the Victim Survivor Support Organization Just Alternatives, and journalist Bradford Pearson, whose article My Kidnappers appears in the September issue of Philadelphia Magazine. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Bradford Pearson, whose article My Kidnappers was in the September issue of Philadelphia Magazine. You can find it online at phillymag.com. John Wilson is with us as well. He's founder of the Victim Survivor Support Organization Just Alternatives. We're talking about what can happen when crime victims and offenders reconnect with one another. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Brad, you were telling me in the break that you sensed that Jerry and Tyree both were nervous about meeting you.
Yeah, that was something I didn't really expect going in. We had both, I guess all three of us had sort of gotten a sense of who we were and what our expectations were through a few letters beforehand. And this is something that Jerry and Tyree both laid out in their letters, that they were totally okay with me coming in, screaming at them, yelling at them, cursing them out, spitting on them, whatever, literally. And I the first time I went in, I had no idea how I was going to deal with that. And it was great. I don't know. It was almost, I had a real sense of calm when I was there. And I know that they were surprised by my reaction. And I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back, because literally walking through the prison doors, I had no idea how I was going to react the first time I saw either of them. But it also made me think and believe and know that these are still people. These are still people that have emotions. These are people that are worried about the way people are going to treat them, even if it's because of something that they did. And seeing that and knowing and recognizing that they have the same sort of emotions as I do, it's really disarming.
John, I know that it's like a stipulation of the work that you do that the offenders, if they agree to this, there's no special consideration by the parole board. They're not offered any, you know, new placement. They don't get a prize for agreeing to do this. But I also wonder when you think about what would motivate the offenders to meet up with the people they have hurt. If there's an effect on recidivism, is there anybody tracking this? Are they less likely to go out and do something bad again after they're released from prison?
Yeah, this is a great question. You know, we have not done this. This field has in victim offender dialogue and crimes of severe violence has only really been going since 1993. And by the way, Texas was the trailbreaker and the road builder for this. Everything that we do in victim-centered, victim-offender dialogue practice follows on what the state of Texas did, the Victim Services Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice did. And that's where I was trained, and I will forever be grateful that I was lucky enough to be trained in that, in there. The truth is that when offenders are sort of confronted, and I'll use that word, although, you know, it's a confrontation in a way. When they're confronted by the survivors, they have a number of different kinds of reactions. But if I might go back to something Brad said, when offenders say, you know, they can spit at me, they can yell at me, they can call me names, you know, they have every right. When they say things like that, you know that they're sincere. The offenders who don't say that, you know, they may be being authentic. That is, they may be revealing who they are, but you know, they feel like, you know, we should all just get over it and we should, you know, we can't, you know, we, you know, it doesn't, we should forgive because, you know, it's not going to be, you know, it's only going to eat us up. I mean, they have lots of good platitudes. But when an offender says, you know, they have every right to do anything they want to me, that's a colossally great thing. And it's a great indicator. And I find that happening more often than not. On the other hand, there are plenty of offenders who just think, you know, if she starts to raise her voice, I'm just going to get up and walk out, which they also have the right to do. You know, a survivor has either one of them can stop this in the middle of the dialogue for reasons known only to them. That's part of the deal, because we have to make it possible for this to be as authentic an exchange for the hours and hours that it's going to go on. And most of them will go, let's say, 5-6 hours, 4-6 hours, these conversations. And, you know, they have to be able to know that either one, if he or she doesn't like what he or she is hearing, has the right to stop it. And Chris, I'm sorry to say that I've forgotten your question. I apologize.
I was asking about recidivism rates.
Oh, recidivism. Sorry. Research. This is, as long as this has been going on, there has not been much research on recidivism, partly because many of the offenders are in for very long. These are crimes of severe violence, remember. So they're in. They might be doing life sentences. They might be doing long, long sentences. So some offenders have been released, and my guess is that they have not recidivated. They're, I'm sure in some crimes, offenders who've been through interchanges with survivors have recidivated. But the recidivism quotient, that research has not been done, and the National Victim Services Professionals and Corrections, an organization of professionals, is trying hard to change that. We need this research because we know what it will show, that the recidivism rate is lower. The behavior rate, the disciplinary record rate, is lower, but that's not something that is a standard measure among in the national corrections field. It's a local, it's a facility measure. I hope I'm answering your question. It's not a very good answer. There isn't a very good answer.
You don't have the data yet, so maybe we can follow up in a couple of years. Let's go to the phone right now. We have Katie on the line in Plano. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. I was just wondering, my question is for John, really. In your experience, have you worked with any victims who knew their offender, who've had some sort of an intimate relationship with their offender, such as maybe a victim of childhood sexual assault? And if so, were those experiences different for those victims than, you know, say someone who didn't know their offender, who it was, you know, some sort of a random act of violence? And how do you, you know, differ the process you know, for that victim and that offender, if you have done any of that work. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. It's a great question, Katie. Yes, I have done that work. And that work is some of the most complex work that there is to do, because especially in childhood sexual abuse by a family member, let's just take that to start with, you know, the offender is a persuasive, manipulative, generally minimizing, sometimes denying, generally prevaricating person who's clever with words and clever at making the victim feel as if he or she was equally responsible. So there's a, you know, there's a degree of manipulation that goes with that kind of predation that has to be worked with by the facilitator has to understand the nature of offenders like that and has to understand the nature of survivors who have been through that, because they have been, in effect, you could say, kidnapped in their own homes by the machinations and manipulations of an offender. The same thing could happen with, you know, there are husbands, spouses who've assaulted their wives, who've gone to prison for those assaults, and they have their own ways of manipulating the situation. And they, these two areas, domestic violence and sexual violence, incest in particular, but family, trusted adult or trusted other sexual violence, those two categories require special care in the facilitation because of the nature of those offenders. They are very, very clever. They're very, very charming. They really work to make you think that they, you know, they didn't know they were doing anything wrong. They didn't mean to do anything wrong. But, you know, our relationship, they might talk about, a father might talk about his quote-unquote relationship with his daughter, which he makes her a kind of a, not a compliant, but a, you know, a consenting partner in. And a wife who, you know, who didn't leave because there are so many reasons, you know, he will blame her. Like, if she had only not been this way, I would not have hit her. I would not have stabbed her. I would not have tried to kill her. I mean, the things that they make up are really unbelievable. And so that preparation process it has to be exquisitely sensitive, and it has to be done by a facilitator who understands those kinds of offenders and those kinds of survivors.
Brad, were you prepared for how many people read your essay, felt they knew everything they could possibly know about you, and felt comfortable judging your decision in a very critical way?
I was surprised by how many people that had never been through an experience like this thought that what I did was wrong, and thought that that Jerry and Tyree deserved no sympathy or no forgiveness. It was, I don't want to say hurtful, because it wasn't, because most of the comments have been, and most of the emails, and I've received a lot of emails from either people who have been assaulted or kidnapped themselves or have had family members kidnapped, and those have helped me outweigh the mm-hmm. people who think that either what I did was stupid or liberal white guilt was thrown around a lot. And I kind of just want to say to them, sorry, you have no idea what the last 9 years have been like for me. I'm allowed to make this decision. I'm allowed to write about it in the way that I want to write about it and how this has affected me, my family, and my friends. And frankly, my view on the justice system, which is more positive after this experience than it was 9 years ago when this happened. So I forget your question at the beginning, but I just know that folks that read this, read the entire thing, got through 5,000 words, and that's what they know about me, have felt it their place to say that what I did was either stupid or that I was just playing into some sort of prison system game.
John,
Chris, can I add something
please.
In here? Because this is so important.
I know
Thank
that you,
you
deal
so
with this all the time as well.
All the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, family members, you know, you have survivors in, you know, let's say a father, a husband and father has been murdered, and one of the daughters or one of the sons or the widow wants to meet with the offender, and everyone else in the family does not want them to meet with the offender because the offender is a quote-unquote monster. And for all the emails that Brad has experienced, and I think it's a terribly, viciously wounding thing to do that to a survivor when you have no idea what their story is, except, you know, as Brad says, the 5,000 words that you read. You know, it's one of the things that is so hard for a facilitator because the survivor is struggling with, I want to meet with these guys or this guy, but no one in my family wants me to. Or I don't forgive this guy. This is the opposite of that. I don't forgive this guy, and everybody else in my family and all my friends think I should forgive this guy, and I'm not forgiving him. And so this, you know, what survivors struggle with, it's just heartbreaking. And most people don't hear this part of their experience. Like, everybody thinks, well, you know, you've been through something, but at least you didn't die. You're all right. You know, everything's okay. We're good, right? And it's not like that. It's, you know, I suspect for Brad it's a day-to-day thing. And obviously he has considerable control over it and has done beautifully in the aftermath of that. And some survivors do that and some survivors do not.
Is there something we could do to work something like this more regularly into the criminal justice process? I know, again, that in many trials there's the opportunity for victims to make an impact statement, but it doesn't sound like those sink in that moment of great emotion when the verdict has just been announced or when the sentence is being announced.
Right. And if you're addressing me, this is John.
Yeah.
I think there is more that can be done. I mean, you think about a survivor who's, you know, been waiting a year, say, for this. Let's say they didn't plead. Let's say they pled not guilty. And so it takes a year or more for the trial to occur. The survivor has been through this waiting period, and then suddenly there's a guilty verdict, and only then is the possibility of a victim impact statement allowed at the sentencing hearing. And only then can you speak for a few minutes about something that has devastated your life in a public setting to a person who may or may not be listening, because he can't be made to listen. You know, the offender might be sitting at the table with his defense lawyer looking at the ceiling while you sort of try to pour your heart out or pour your anger out. And most of the survivors who get to do that feel it's a great thing. It's a great thing that victim impact statements exist. And they do touch offenders in some way, but it's nowhere near enough for a survivor. So I think that that's one of the things. I think that, first of all, we have to normalize the idea of survivors meeting with offenders, because most people are thinking you shouldn't talk with them, or you should talk with them only to forgive them, or, you know, or you should talk with them only to scream at them. And, you know, people are wondering how to make sense of this experience. So we need to make that conversation happen more.
John Wilson is founder of the Victim Survivor Support Organization Just Alternatives. Bradford Pearson is a journalist, managing editor at Southwest, the magazine. His article, My Kidnappers, appears in the September issue of Philadelphia Magazine. You can find it online at phillymag.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
It was an honor. Thank you.
And for me. And again, Brad, beautiful article. Thank you for writing.
Yeah, thank you for your work, John.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.